constitutional amendments, the citrus crops competitor, and commissioned local art. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. There are a dozen constitutional amendments on this year's Florida ballot. Some are bunched together. We're going to hear from the ACLU Florida about a few of those ballot measures and try to help you get some background before you decide to vote. Plus, citrus growers have lost millions in crops over the years due to storms and disease. But researchers at the University of Florida are looking into a potential replacement for citrus. Could vanilla one day become the top crop in the Sunshine State? And you subscribe for television, movies, and music services. But what if there were a similar service so you could subscribe to get artwork? Yes, an artist who'll create pieces for you. We'll talk about a program that's already underway in South Florida. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, when the ballots go out starting this weekend, you're going to notice quite a few constitutional amendments to choose from. There are 12 in all. There were 13, but a Florida court removed one of them. And of those 12, a handful are bundled together. There are challenges in court now to stop a couple of those bundled amendments. Now, one of the amendments that's gotten a lot of attention is Amendment 4, which gives voting rights back to those who are convicted felons who served their time. It's gotten so much attention, it's actually going national. It was a skit on the John Oliver Show the last week tonight, and here's a cut from the program where Governor Rick Scott defended the current status in Florida.
Look, if you are a convicted felon, part of what you did is you lost your rights. And so you ought to, you know, there ought to be a process if you're going to get those rights back. And I think it's fair to the rest of the citizens of the state, and they'll see a process that they know will work.
Well, joining us now to understand a few of the choices that will be on the ballot is Melba Pearson of the ACLU Florida. The Greater Miami chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union is hosting a panel discussion about the referendum this Sunday at the Palmetto Branch Public Library. It's at noon. It's free. It's open to the public. Mrs. Pearson, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
There's a lot to talk about. We're going to try to cover just a few big ones here. And between now and Election Day, we're going to make sure that we have at least covered, we're going to cover all of them to make sure voters are up to speed with everything. This is the most amendments that have been on a ballot for voters. 1998, there were nine. That's the last time the Constitution Revision Commission met. What do you think about the fact that there's so much to pick from? Is that a good thing? I mean, more choices? Or is it a bad thing because, well, more choices?
Yeah, it is definitely a mixed bag because of the fact that it's tough as it is for voters to stay on top of everything, to stay informed. And especially when you have the situation of so many of the amendments being bundled, it ends up being very confusing. So that's why we've been fighting in court to make sure that the amendments are one topic and easy for the voters to understand.
So it's not, you don't think it's a good idea to bundle them. You'd rather, if we're going to have 12, or 13, we had 13 originally, just put them all out there one by one, let people decide.
Absolutely, because again, the bundling often involves two or three different topics that have nothing to do with each other. So it's sort of like, am I for e-cigarettes or vaping or am I not? But then again, am I going to be able to watch dog racing? It's just, you know, it becomes absurd.
Well, one of them is actually combined, you know, the issue of e-cigarettes and vaping and offshore oil drilling.
Right.
So there's two, it's two very different things, and you may stand differently on these issues.
Exactly. So it's not really giving the voters a fair opportunity to let their voices be heard on a particular topic.
You know, the last time that the CRC, this commission, put, again, in 1998, they had nine amendments on the ballot. Most of them passed. But does that tell you anything about whether or not, again, having a lot of issues, a lot to choose through, pick through on a ballot is a good or bad thing? You know, this is a midterm.
Correct.
But it's going to be a very busy ballot.
It is. And again, especially with so many different races that are critical coming up at this midterm election, it just makes the ballot very long. And the thing that I worry about is voter engagement. Are folks going to really stick it out through the end and flip the ballot over and go all the way to the bottom of the page? We encourage everyone to do so and to make sure they do their research in advance. I mean, we have our positions on the ACLUFL.org website. you know, go online, do your research, and, you know, look at your sample ballot before you go into the ballot box.
What's been your experience when it comes to dealing with voters? And, you know, when they're looking at the ballot and then they start getting to races, like judges, for example, or they get to all these amendments and it's like, I don't know anything about this one. Go with the first thing that's on the list. We saw that with judges.
Right.
They tend to pick the first one.
Yeah. And again, I really caution people not to do that because the first one may not necessarily be the best one. You know, it's only like a 50-50 shot because you're taking a shot in the dark as to whether or not someone is going to be qualified to sit on the bench, to sit in judgment of people, to advance criminal justice reform or to hinder it. You know, so judges play a huge role in our system and it shouldn't be something that you pick at random or willy-nilly because you just want to get through the ballot.
All right, let's talk about some of the amendments. And again, the ACLU supports some of them and opposes others. Let's look at the one that I mentioned in the introduction. This has been maybe the biggest one, Amendment 4. Again, getting voting rights back to those who were convicted felons. 13 states, are including Florida, have the same situation where basically you lose your rights after you have to wait so many years and then go back and hope the governor will give them back to you. It's a very long process, and there's no guarantee that you will get them back. But the ACLU supports the reinstatement of voting rights to these folks. When did Florida begin this practice, by the way? I mean, how long have we been doing this?
This has been going on for hundreds of years. It's basically a holdover from Jim Crow and from the slavery era. We're only one of four states that has a process that's so incredibly restrictive. Other states have some measures in place, but again, it's not one of those things where you may never get your voting rights back. And as a matter of fact, there's actually two states where you can vote while you are in custody.
I think Vermont is one of them.
Yes. I believe the other one is either New Hampshire or Maine.
Okay.
I think it's New Hampshire. But again, this affects 1.4 million people in the state of Florida. And it's unjust because at the end of the day, if you have served your sentence, if you have paid your restitution, paid your fines, done everything you were supposed to do, why can't you get your rights back? It doesn't make our communities any safer.
Yeah, you heard the cut from the governor earlier, you know, and he's basically saying, look, once you've committed a specific crime, you're a felon, you lose your rights. And you should have to go through a process to get them back. What is your take on what he said and his stance on this?
I wholeheartedly disagree because, again, it doesn't make our communities any safer. If someone has the ability, let's look at what voting entails. It gives you the ability to have a say on your roads, on who is going to be on your school board to help educate your kids, you know, who is going to be trying to get funding for your neighborhood. You know, these are all important things that have to do with the communities people live in. And if you take away people's right to vote and say you can never be fully engaged in the community, how are you encouraging them to reintegrate and be part of said community?
You know, this is, I mean, it's a purple state, but at the same time, you know, the Republican Party has controlled the governor's mansion and the legislature, both chambers, for quite some time. Do you think this has a chance? I mean, the voters have pretty much said, because they supported Scott and reelected him. They supported his position on this. I mean, that they said so when they voted him in. Right.
Well, yes and no. From the standpoint of, was that really a discussion during the election at that time? I don't believe it was. I think there were other issues that were more top of mind. But, you know, again, change happens. You know, we never thought we would see legalization of marijuana for recreational use across the country. And we've seen multiple states do that. We now have medical marijuana in the state of Florida. So people can change. Viewpoints do change. And the research that we've done and the polling that we've done indicates that people support this, that when you have done your time, you deserve a second chance. And this is what it's about, second chances.
And just to clarify, too, is that felons who are convicted of sex crimes and I believe homicide,
correct,
are able to get back their voting rights at all. I'm speaking with Melba Pearson, Deputy Director of the ACLU in Florida. We're discussing a number of the constitutional amendments on this year's ballot for voters to pick through. The ACLU will be hosting an event again Sunday, open to the public, which will go over all of the amendments on this year's ballot. And I want to repeat that. It is open to the public Sunday at noon at the Palmetto Branch Public Library. So that way, if you have any questions, perhaps about, again, a lot that you're going to have to pick through in this year's ballot,
That way you can educate yourself before you vote. Let's look at another one, Amendment 6, this one known as Marcy's Law. This is really two judicial issues put in one. One of these things is about a part of Amendment 6 is about raising the age of retirement for judges from 70 to 75, and the other one has to do with victims' rights in crimes. The ACLU opposes this, right?
That is correct.
Okay. What is it the whole, I mean, the whole amendment, or is it, are we just talking about the victims' rights part of it?
We're talking about the misnamed victims' rights part of it. So let me give you a little background. I'm a former prosecutor. I was a prosecutor in Miami for 16 years. I'm well-versed on victims' rights. And the Florida Constitution, as it stands right now, has a very robust victims' rights section. Victims have the right to be heard. They have the right to be present in all stages of the proceedings, whether it be the filing of charges, arraignment, trial, every aspect of trial, as well as sentencing. They have the right to be informed on what is happening with the case. So this constitutional amendment does not change anything from that perspective. But what it does do, it does give corporations the same footing as human victims. So in other words, you can now have corporations coming into criminal proceedings with high-priced lawyers trying to dictate how the criminal justice process should go.
Can you think of an example to help us get a picture of what that might look like? Have you seen that happen before? Have they, where corporations tried?
So one example would be, let's say you have a young man who shoplifted something from Walmart, and Walmart decides they want to make this particular young man an example. And they show up with a high-priced attorney, and they start to try to bully the prosecutor or the parties involved to send this young man to jail. Let's say he's 19 years old. This is his first offense. The normal course of action would be maybe some sort of diversion program, maybe, you know, stay out of trouble for the next 6 months, pay them back whatever it is you stole, and the charges would be dismissed. But instead, under this amendment, you could have a scenario where the corporate lawyers have equal footing and now will say, no, we're not going to agree to any sort of diversion. We want this young man, even though he doesn't have a history, to go to prison. And you know, that can corrupt the whole proceedings.
And this, you know, this was, you know, basically kind of modeled after, it was a law in California, and it was a heinous crime against a young woman. But I mean, do you worry that because of that, and the history behind that story, that the voter is going to look at it and say, well, of course, I want to fight for the victim.
And let's be clear. We all want to see victims have rights and be protected. No one should have to go through the pain of being victimized and then be re-victimized by the system. So we are not opposed to victims' rights. But we in Florida are blessed with a very strong constitutional provision for victims already. So victims are already protected. This amendment is not going to provide any additional protections to the victim, but it also chips away at the rights of the accused. So it starts to attack whether or not the victim or any witnesses have to attend a deposition. Now, not to get in the weeds, but in Florida, we have the ability to have a deposition where the defense attorney can ask questions of the victim and find out how they would testify at trial. This is the right of the defendant to be able to find out, okay, this is what the person's saying, and you can make a decision whether or not you want to go to trial, you want to take a plea. As a prosecutor, being able to take a deposition is huge because then I can assess the credibility of my victim and decide, this case is falling apart, I need to drop it, or yes, my case is very strong, and then the defense decides to take a plea. If the victim no longer gets involved in that process, again, the accused is handicapped. And if, God forbid, you're ever in that situation where you're accused of a crime, you would want all of the information available to decide what your options are and what's the best thing to do, go to trial or take a plea. Additionally, this proposed amendment would shorten the window of appeal. So suppose you've been convicted, but you know all along that you are innocent, and there was some evidence that came to light 5 years after your conviction. This amendment would make it almost impossible for you to be able to file a motion to say, look, I'm innocent, look at this new evidence. It's basically saying all appeals have to be filed within a 2-year window, and that's just not practical. So again, you know, the victims in Florida are well protected, more so than other places in the country. And we cannot chip away at the right of the accused, because then that's attacking the very foundation of our democracy.
Let's hit on one more here. Amendment 11. This one also covering quite a few things in one package. I mean, it repeals the state's ability to prohibit non-citizens from buying, owning, or selling property, deals with how we prosecute people under outdated laws. It also has a provision that deals with obsolete language about high-speed rail. Where's the ACLU on this amendment?
So we support this amendment for several reasons. Number one, the language about someone who is not a citizen not being able to own or sell property is racist. If someone is able to afford it, why are we, first of all, as a society, not going to be able to collect property taxes or anything like that?
And I believe that in the language, it says alien.
Right. And alien. I mean, that's racist. So that's one aspect. The second aspect is, let's say we pass full legalization of marijuana in the state of Florida. Okay, let's just use that hypothetical. We do that. So that means, let's say we pass it today. From today forward, you cannot be arrested for possession of a certain amount of marijuana or anything like that. What about all the people who are now currently sitting in jail for that marijuana charge that is now legal? Shouldn't they be able to be released from jail and have that removed from their record? Because this is no longer a crime. We've decided that this is no longer a crime. So this amendment would allow that statute to apply retroactively to people who are affected.
And, you know, as I mentioned at the beginning, is that some of these are being challenged right now in court. I believe 3 of the amendments are currently in court, could be removed from the ballot. One of those is Amendment 11. I mean, if that's the case, what would the ACLU's response be then?
Well, then we'd be focusing on the amendments that are still going to be on the ballot.
Okay. I wanted to get to real quickly this event that's coming up. So people, again, open to the public, free and open to the public, so people can educate themselves on the amendments. How is it going to be set up? Is it basically, you know, here are the amendments as they're going to be seen on the ballot, and let's just go through them so you understand what they are. Is it a Q&A? How will it be organized?
Well, I'm very honored to be moderating that panel. And we're going to have 3 panelists that will include Ruben Roberts from the NAACP here in Miami-Dade County, our public defender, Carlos Martinez, as well as someone who is a returning citizen who has, you know, gone through the process and will be directly impacted by our vote on Amendment 4. So I'll be looking at these amendments through the lens of 3 different individuals who are involved in the community, have been affected or work within the criminal justice system, and can kind of educate folks from a real world perspective rather than just the theory.
Let me finish with this real quickly. I mean, we live in this, well, say the information age. Look, there's so many ways to get in touch with people. Do you think we do enough to reach people and educate voters before they go in to the ballot box?
I think we do a lot. I think we could always do more. But I always encourage the voters. Sometimes, you know, life gets in the way. You're busy, you're working, you're taking care of your family. But we're in the internet age. Everybody pretty much has a smartphone. Go on our website, aclufl.org, or whatever organization that you feel tied to, and look at their positions on the different ballots. Use Google, you know, use whatever Bing, whatever search engine makes you happy. But make sure to research, get that sample ballot. I believe it's miamidade.gov, if I'm not mistaken, where you can get the sample ballot based on your geographic location, and educate yourself.
Yeah, if you, I can say if you Google Florida amendments 2018, you're going to get a pretty long list of basically a lot of sites that are going to share with you at least what those amendments are. Melba Pearson, again, Deputy Director of the ACLU in Florida. Again, they're hosting an event, the Greater Miami Chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union, hosting a panel discussion about the referendum this Sunday at the Palmetto Branch Public Library at noon, free and open to the public. Melba, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, still to come, as farmers in the center of the state are still reeling from citrus greening, could help be coming in the form of, say, vanilla? That's all next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, when you think about the crop that defines Florida, what's the first thing that comes to mind? I mean, I'm willing to bet you're thinking citrus, right? Because, well, it's citrus. According to the USDA, the top crops in Florida, tomatoes, sugarcane, and of course, number one, oranges. But the citrus industry has taken big hits over the decades with diseases and storms. And no one's saying that citrus is going to die out in the Sunshine State, but there are farmers already looking for alternatives because of the massive declines in their crops. One alternative may be vanilla. Researchers with the University of Florida say a hybrid vanilla plant has a lot of promise. They're working in developing a crop through combining the genes of native and non-native vanilla plants to create a more resilient plant that could potentially withstand severe hurricanes and diseases. The vanilla crop wouldn't require any extra acreage and could blossom harmoniously by winding up the trunks of trees like mango and avocado. We're joined in studio now with the tropical fruits breeder, Dr. Alan Chambers, assistant professor of genetics and the breeding of tropical fruit with the University of Florida's Institute of Food and Agricultural Sciences. Alan, you want me to call you Alan? Alan, welcome to the program. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Why vanilla?
Vanilla is an amazing crop, number one. It's known globally, so it has a massive appeal around the world. It's also gives a good economic return.
It is really valuable right now.
Right now, it's especially valuable, around $600 per kilogram for the cured bean. So you could deal in silver, you could deal in vanilla.
I read that it's actually right now more valuable than silver.
Yeah, it's not always the case. Right now, there's a number of factors that have contributed to this price hike. But even independent of that, you've got a massive market around the world, and it is something that really resonates with consumers.
Real quickly, just remind us, where does vanilla come from?
So about 70 to 80% of the vanilla from vanilla orchids is grown in Madagascar, and then with a smattering from other countries, including India, Indonesia, Mexico, Uganda, other nations.
So it can grow. Can it grow anywhere? Is it really that resilient?
It's a pretty hardy plant, and it does come as long as it's warm. So subtropical locations, you give it a hard freeze, and this plant is going to die.
Yeah, and it's, I think, as I said at the beginning, too, is the fact that it can grow with other trees, with other plants.
And that's part of the beauty. It's a shade-loving plant, and so you have to give it something to grow on. So you can either grow it in a shade house, or you can grow it on another tree. And so they actually do grow this in some other countries on citrus itself. Any other support structure that gives a little bit of shade and protection could be a suitable alternative.
Do you think this could be the future for Florida? And again, because on the show, we've talked about citrus, and every year the numbers just keep dropping and dropping. The diseases and everything has really been hurting the business. So we got to think about something else, right? Do you think that vanilla could become a major crop in Florida?
I would certainly love to see vanilla become a major crop. One of the challenges, though, with replacing citrus is, number one, I'd rather we didn't replace it. I'd rather we saved it. And we drink a lot of orange juice. And so any single commodity to, quote, replace orange would be very challenging. But it could be a viable opportunity for our growers and be a nice niche market for Florida.
Let's talk about your research, though, specifically what you're trying to do. And help us understand this combining of native and non-native, genes of this plant. What are you doing right now?
So the first step is a little more simple even than that, is we are bringing in the commercial species from different botanical gardens, hobbyists, and even internationally, and we're going to see which ones grow well here, and then make those available to growers so they can start with what currently exists and start growing their own vanilla. The next step is to make a better vanilla. And so we think about, by analogy, apples. You look in the grocery store and you see maybe a dozen different kinds of apples. So why does there only need to be one kind of vanilla? Why can't we have specialty types, especially those that are grown in South Florida that help our growers?
You say better vanilla? Are you talking about the resiliency of the plant? Or are you talking about a better flavor?
I'm talking about a better flavor. Everything I do has a bent on consumer quality. We want something that tastes better, has a different application, something that's a little more exciting than yesterday's flavors.
Is it something easy for farmers to just start growing? I mean, because you think about certain crops, and you would have to, if you change crops, you'd have to go in and you've got to rebuild your field, you know, for whatever it is that you're going to start growing. But with vanilla, is that something that they could easily just implement and start doing?
Vanilla would be easy to grow. The biggest challenge that those who are interested now is getting the numbers of plants that they need. I mean, so per acre, or if you want to set up, say, 5 acres of vanilla, you need thousands of plants. We're having a hard time finding those, either domestically or internationally. That's the number one challenge. Other than that, vanilla doesn't need a lot to get growing. A little bit of organic fertilizer, a little bit of sunlight and a nice rainy season and lots of warm weather.
Now you got me thinking though about the, you know, better tasting vanilla, but you know, how do you do that? How does that work?
So it's all about picking the right parents and mixing pollen from one flower onto the pollen of flower of another plant. And this is what plant breeders have been doing for centuries. And it's a process that can lead to improved types. And the native species, like you asked for, those can be adapted to South Florida. We have four native vanilla species in South Florida. So some of those might have secrets that could help our growers be more profitable, either new flavors or, like you say, it could be resistant to some diseases that we have in Florida.
All right, so paint the picture for me, though. It's like, as I'm picturing you now, what, in your lab, and you're just, you know, trying to mix different plants to find, I guess, that magic combination?
That's correct. And so this is something that anyone could do in their own garden as well. The difference is we bring a lot of the heavy techniques that help the process be more efficient.
One of the things I had read is that a lot of it's by hand. I mean, you're taking stuff from the plants to put in that breeding process, in the pollination process.
Correct. So actually every vanilla bean has to be, that flower that results in the bean has to be manually pollinated. So someone had to go to that flower itself and take the pollen and attach it to the stigma so it could produce that bean. And the process would be similar. If you wanted to take two different parents, pollen from one, you'd remove that pollen and put it on the other flower.
Is this just the process of trying to, you know, pollinate these plants and finding that solution that you're looking for the better vanilla? Or are any of these seeds in any way being genetically modified?
So not in the sense that most consumers or most of our listeners would be thinking about in terms of a GMO label. And so this would be more of a conventional approach that would be available to an organic production system as well as a conventional system.
Again, I'm talking with Dr. Alan Chambers, an assistant professor of genetics and breeding of tropical fruit with the University of Florida's Institute of Food and Agricultural Sciences. And we're talking about vanilla crop as a possible, well, not replacement for citrus, but look, citrus is hurting. And that's one of the things that people are talking about is, well, if we can't save it or if it can't be as profitable as it used to be, what other crops could we grow? Vanilla may be one of those options. We talk about the resilience of the plant and is, from what you found so far, how does it handle the issues of climate change and what we've seen so far in Florida with temperatures going up? The season seems to be lasting longer, but also dealing with a lot of dryness as well.
Yeah, so vanilla grows best when it has a defined rainy season and a defined, quote, dry season or less rainy season, depending. So if you were to blur the lines between those seasons, it could impact the flowering of the vines. And so as a grower, you'd have a harder time getting the volume of flowers that you need that then results in pods later. With the increase in temperature, it might mean that we could grow this farther north or farther inland with increasing temperatures. I'm not saying that increasing temperatures is a good thing, but in terms of the plant itself, it could grow in a wider distribution.
And you look at the, you know, Florida, I mean, there is a difference in what you see, what can be grown in northern Florida to southern Florida. I mean, is there a particular part of the state where it would be really advantageous to try to grow vanilla?
So we're starting about as far north as we can go, down where we're located in Homestead. We know that there are growers over on Pine Island, as well as going up towards Stuart, Florida. So right now we're targeting areas that can grow mango profitably. And we know that the vanilla, well, we think the vanilla should do well there. And then we're moving inland, but very cautiously.
What about diseases? Because, I mean, as we mentioned with citrus greening has been a big issue and other diseases. What do we know about vanilla and its resilience towards diseases, or are there any things that we have to worry about?
So vanilla, we believe, is mostly a wild species. And so as it's taking from the wild, we haven't had a lot of time to remove some beneficial genes from vanilla in general. It's propagated by cutting, so you literally cut the plant and then it will root and create a new plant. And so there are some challenges we find internationally. There are some root rots. Some of that can be ameliorated by less water on the root substrate. You grow this in a mulch. But there also are species out there that are resistant to this root rot problem. And something that I think our Florida growers could leverage is this a hybrid between those species.
How often do you spend time with growers? I mean, I want to get a sense from you of what, if you do, what do they say to you? What are their biggest concerns? And what, you know, when you talk about vanilla, what do they say?
Yeah, so I'm fortunate enough to be able to spend about 20% of my time on paper with growers. And so I field emails, we get phone calls, I go and visit growers, and growers come visit me. And I think it's essential for the success of my position to do that. As far as the vanilla conversation goes, the biggest question we get is, I want a 1,000 or 10,000 plants, where do I get them? And that's hard because we can't provide that, and I can't point them to a source for vanilla. Then the other questions come, you know, when can I expect a return? When do we start getting yield? How would I grow this? These are all questions we're actively working on in response to the growers' questions.
And they got to be watching what's going on around the world when it comes to vanilla. Because again, I mean, the prices are up, but we talk about, for example, and this also links to climate change. We look at the climate change on the vanilla crop in places like Madagascar. Price went from $20 a kilo 5 years ago, $600 a kilo, last number that we saw. I mean, what are their concerns about, you know, again, those the risks of climate change here in the state and how it could fluctuate? That's a massive price fluctuation, which means it could fall just as fast.
That's correct. And that's one of the big challenges with having, there's a lot of risk with growing 80% of our vanilla in Madagascar. You get a cyclone through, and that can be exacerbated by theft, which is the current problem. Those prices will most likely come down again. But in South Florida, most of our growers are they're entrepreneurial and they're risk takers to a certain degree. And so we're also trying to create a market opportunity that is a little more resilient to imports. And so we're not looking at a commodity vanilla. We want something special for our growers, something that you can stamp with, you know, fresh from Florida, something that's local, maybe something that's organic, something that sets apart our vanilla from other vanillas.
When do you think you'd see this happening? Is it already happening? I mean, are growers already buying in?
We have some people that have already started putting plants in the ground. Again, there's small numbers of these now. And then again, giving us their feedback on what they would like to see happening. So it's starting now. It's a little slower going than we'd like to see. And I think that the growers would like to see. But every industry has to start somewhere.
Yeah, and I'm curious what you think the future is going to look like for vanilla. Are you optimistic? I'm sure you are, but that in 5, 7, 10 years, this could be a major crop.
What I would like to see in 5 to 7 years is our first harvest coming out and see some smiles on some growers as well as some consumers saying, you know, we grew this in our backyard and that's fabulous. 10 to 15 years, it'd be interesting if we could have a Florida bred variety, at least in the first stages of testing here. But again, it all depends on a number of factors, and we're going to make the best effort we can.
Is it going to be expensive for farmers to get into, though?
It depends. I mean, so in South Florida, we are used to higher agricultural inputs. And so it depends on your system. If you need a shade house, that's an expensive bit of infrastructure. But we all have a lot of growers that are used to producing under shade houses. If you use trees and you've already got the trees, you can buy plants for a couple dollars a piece up to a couple of tens of dollars a piece. And those plants should be in production for somewhere around 6 to 8 years. And so if you're still getting a decent yield off of those plants, you should be able to get a decent return.
I want to come back real quickly to the lab and the work that you're doing, again, to try to find that better tasting vanilla. How far are you into that process? I mean, will you ever feel like, I've reached that place, I did it, I created the ultimate vanilla?
That wouldn't be very good for job security, would it?
That's true.
There's always, consumer needs evolve, pathogens evolve and adapt. So there's always going to be a need for genetic improvement of plants. But what we are getting good at is identifying, you know, even how to run. What does vanilla flavor mean to people? What do they really want? So when you look at the aroma of vanilla from the orchid, it's not just one scent. It's a bouquet of different aromas. So which ones are the most important? Which ones should we target? How do we detect those? So those are the things we're working on now. So what do people like the most in the extract, and how do we optimize that for our needs?
Vanilla, could it become a big cash crop here in the state of Florida? Not saying it'll replace anything, but could it become as big as citrus? Dr. Alan Chambers, again, Assistant Professor of Genetics and Breeding of Tropical Fruit with the University of Florida's Institute of Food and Agricultural Sciences. He's working on trying to create that perfect vanilla bean, probably, I'm sure. Alan, thanks so much, man. It's been a pleasure.
Pleasure. Thank you.
And I'll get you back in here when vanilla does become a cash crop in the state of Florida. All right, still to come, you know, we subscribe to a lot of services. Think about it, for music, movies, television. But what about a service where you could subscribe so you can get art It's real. I'm going to tell you all about it coming up next on the program. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, you may subscribe to television services, maybe to a wine club or local farmers markets, but what if there was a program where you could subscribe to local artists, invest in their work, and collect their pieces? A new program from the Knight Foundation, the company We're By Us, publishers of The New Tropic, and the Miami Gallery Primary is doing exactly that. It's called Commissioner. And the idea is simple. 40 collectors pay $300 a quarter, $900 a year. Every couple months, a local artist will commission 40 unique pieces for the collectors. There will also be gallery showings, educational programs from the artist, and collector meetups. For $50 a month, patrons can get access to all the events. Deja Carrington is the founder of Commissioner, and she joins us in studio. Deja, thank you so much for being here. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Also joining us is Miami-based multi-platform artist Typo Gran. Gran is the fine artist to be commissioning pieces and will release them at his first solo show in five years in Miami this upcoming October 2nd. Typo, thank you so much, man. I really appreciate the time.
Yeah, it's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
You know what, Deja, let me start with you. Just give us a basic idea of Commissioner and how it was conceived. What was the reasoning behind it?
So I work with Young Arts, and our main mission is to support the next generation of artists. And in Miami, there's been a big conversation around affordable housing, affordable studio space for artists. But what we also need is an audience, a market to support the artists. And we need to think about arts patronage in a different way. I think that there's a real opportunity for locals who live here to get to know the local artists who are creating in their community and who are really pushing the city forward.
This is an interesting take on it because, I mean, look, as an artist, you basically, you always hear the starving artist thing. You know, you go out there, you try to build yourself up, get a reputation and sell some pieces, and then maybe you get into the best galleries. But this is really a way to create work for them.
That's absolutely
It's not just
true.
Branding them, but it's creating work for them.
Yep. And it's really about debunking the starving artist adage. There's no reason that artists should be starving. There's really no reason that anybody should be starving, because I think there's enough compassion, there's enough money, there's enough engagement in the space, especially where we could really be supporting each other. And I think this program is made to connect people in that kind of way.
I needed you when I was starting art school to tell my teachers that. So, but you know, Typo, I wonder, first of all, how'd you get involved?
Deja approached me and basically just asked me if I wanted to be involved and kind of told me the same story she just told you, and I was super excited because I think it's cool to kind of bridge the gap between collectors and artists and kind of people that might not know about collecting.
What do you think about the process, though? Because, I mean, look, and you've been at this for a while, so, you know, before it's like, who did you know? They got you in the galleries. You got out there. There are a lot of different ways today to get yourself out there, your work out there, but this is a way for you to basically, now you're kind of part of the system, and you're going to meet collectors who are, they're looking to you. They're coming to you now.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's cool because a lot of people are scared to jump into that and they don't know how to learn about it. Like, I learned about the art world by taking out the garbage at a gallery for free and painting the walls for free and basically starting from the bottom and just hustling for years until finally people kind of just started asking me about my work and I started coming in and bringing what I do to the table, you know?
What do you think ultimately this could mean for artists? If this grows and expands over the years, what do you think this can mean for artists?
It will cultivate a new level of collectors. They'll just be new collectors, which is what we need. Because I think there's a lot of people in Miami that they do have disposable incomes, and instead of spending it maybe on another Ferrari or whatever else, you know, it's very Miami, but like it is what it is. We're at the place where we're at. Maybe they start collecting art.
Is it? But you know what, Deja, is it just about cultivating, that audience, the people who they have a lot of income to you know, be able to get into the art world or collectors, or to bring in a new type of collector?
It's really to bring in a new type of collector as well. I think that for those who have the disposable income, certainly there's the networking opportunity where maybe we'll be able to turn them on to an artist or to turn them on to a creative that they had no idea existed. And in that instance, they don't really need our program. What they need is an introduction, and they need a connection to facilitate that sale or that space. Our program, through the subscription model, really looks to create an affordable price point where we're pooling all of our collectors, all of our members' monies together, if you will, and then out of that big pool, commissioning four artists one every quarter.
All right, so here, tell us how it's going to work. Let's say I'm a collector.
Yes.
I'm now in the commissioner program, and so I've got the subscription. How many pieces am I getting? How does it work? Do I get to just like reach out to Typo and say, you know what? I mean, my subscription says you've got to give me this much artwork over whatever period of time. I mean, tell me how it works.
Sure. So as a collector, you're paying about $300 a quarter or $900 a year. And the idea is that we're pooling that money with our 39 other people in addition to you to create a pool of approximately 40,000. And out of that, we're splitting it four ways between four different artists, one every quarter. This commission ties you directly to the artists because you will get one piece per quarter in a limited edition of 40. And so at every quarter, you'll go to an artist event, you'll get your piece. Now, because we believe in the artist that we're working with, we're not telling them in advance what to do, that it needs to be a certain size or putting together certain requirements. What we're saying is that we want to be collaborators. We believe in you. We believe in you as a person. And essentially what we want is for you to create a piece out of this commission for our 40 collectors.
I have no say in what the piece is going to be?
You don't. And I think that's really important because we want to talk about arts patronage as investing in people and in their vision. So I think the output, the artwork itself, is very important. But what I think is also important is investing in folks who are creating here in Miami. So if you don't like maybe one of your four pieces, you could put it aside, but trust us that we have chosen up and coming and emerging artists who maybe 3 or 4 years from now, when you're used to seeing them on the gallery walls, you'll feel very good that you got in at the time that you did. I mean, when I think of Typo, for example, he's really a thriving artist and somebody we believe in. I think regardless whether you feel connected to his aesthetic, you can feel connected about how he's creating in Miami.
Again, talking with Deja Carrington, founder of Commissioner and Miami-based artist Typo Gran. Commissioner is a brand-new arts initiative in Miami that allows collectors to invest in local artists for commissioned original pieces each quarter. Patrons, again, can invest in local arts for $50 a year and get access to educational programs as well as events at local studios. Typo, kind of playing off what she just said, though. So, I mean, you still have the freedom as the artist to decide what kind of pieces you want to put together.
Yeah, exactly. Which is fun because there's this fun pressure being the first artist and an honor to kind of kick off the program. So all these people are going to be looking to me like, okay, what's this piece going to be? You know, so I kind of want to like outdo. I kind of want to set the bar high so the other artists have to look and be like, crap, I gotta get to this level or higher, you know, and kind of get up there.
Are all the pieces going to be different?
Yeah, they're all going to be unique. Okay. I'm making 40 unique pieces.
You know, I mean, artists
that are going to be a very good size too. I really want to make this something special for the collectors that are joining this program.
You know, artists going back to before the Renaissance, I mean, they'd make a living by basically being commissioned.
Yes.
By people. I mean, what is that process? And I wonder if you've done that yourself. I mean, do you enjoy that process of being commissioned, or do you think this is a better way where you're not being told what to do, you're creating your own?
Well, actually, most of my work that I sell is commission-based. So clients will come to me and say like, oh, I really love this piece that you did, or this show, or this installation, or this work with this brand. Like, can you do something in this vein, or just show me stuff? So I'll just kind of I'll do like a mock-up of a piece and say, I want to do this for you. And then they commission me. So like, that's kind of where I thrive.
Can you give us a little taste of what you might be doing?
Right now?
Yeah.
Well, so I have my solo show that opens up actually on Friday, September 21st. That's the grand opening. I am doing a store for Adidas right now that's opening on South Beach in between 7th and 8th on Collins. I'm doing, I just did a huge mural, and then there's like a bunch of sculptures that are going throughout the store.
And do any of those in any way link to what you're going to be doing for this program, or are you going totally different?
No, they are all linked together. I sort of have a visual dialogue that you can kind of always follow throughout my work.
When you meet, you know, any of your patrons, I wonder what those conversations are like. You know, what do you typically hear from them? What are sort of the questions that they ask you? Do they want to know about your thinking, your creative process, how you put this piece together, or they just want to know more about you?
Both. I mean, I'm pretty close with a lot of my patrons because I don't make a vast amount of work. Like, I like doing big projects like public art and work with brands and stuff like that because that also helps fund my life, so I don't have to sort of just pump out like little paintings all the time and stuff like that. I really like to keep it limited so it's special. I want people to feel like they're getting something special and something that's unique that's for them.
I noticed too, and this is on a smaller level, but in just artists in general, I'm just trying to get a sense that, you know, today, you know, I can find all these different services online, any kind of app where if I need an artist to even produce a little cover art for something,
yeah,
I can find artists everywhere. I've known writers who they've created comic books, but they're not artists, but they can find artists online,
yeah,
anywhere in the world, hire them for whatever particular job. Mm-hmm. I mean, is this what it's become now? Is basically it is artists for hire or subscription services. This may be the way to go.
Yeah. I mean, there's millions of artists all over in every city. There's artists. I mean, it's a pretty vast pool, you know, so you have to work that much harder to kind of stand out. And I have to travel constantly. I have to go to all the art fairs. I have to be at all the events in different cities, all the openings for all the other artists' shows. You just have to be present. You have to be aware, and you have to be working. Like, if I'm not trying to master my craft, then it's going backwards.
Your initial reaction, though, to this kind of system,
yeah,
do you think there's a future for this? That this could, yeah, be?
I think it's cool. Well, because I think it exists at the same time as everything else. You know, I think it's an added bonus. You know, because I'm meeting 40 new people that I wasn't aware of, that I don't know. So just as much as they're learning about me, I'm learning about them.
And Deesha, real quickly, you have 40 collectors that you picked for the first round, but they're already filled.
They're already filled.
Okay.
So we filled those spaces within the first 12 days, which was pretty incredible. It showed us that there's really a will for people to learn more, but we still have spots available at the $50 a year level, the patron level, where folks can join us to learn more about art collecting, arts patronage, and supporting artists.
Yeah, what does a patron get exactly?
So we do approximately one event per month, and it's always going to be around the arts learning process. So whether it's a studio visit with an artist,
they still get to meet Typo, for example.
Absolutely. Okay. We hope so. And so it's either a studio visit with an artist or going to a collector's home or perhaps going to a talk about art collecting. What we're really trying to do is shift the narrative around what it means to be a patron so that whether you're doing trades with artists or you're buying at the highest levels, you could feel validated as an art collector and really stand forward and feel like wherever you are income level that you own a piece and that you're supporting this community.
Is this something that there'll be another round later on if somebody says, you know what, I want to be a collector. I think that's a decent price, and I'd love to have the opportunity to start collecting some new work.
Absolutely. So we'll be opening our second round for collectors in fall 2019. We're giving our patrons first dibs. Also, people can sign up to our newsletter on commissioner.us to learn more about what we're doing and to become involved now. And hopefully, people who are joining us as patrons will even just meet an artist that they feel connected to, meet a typo, and just talk with him directly about potentially purchasing a piece or learning more about his practice.
Do you have a limit on how many patrons you're going to take?
We don't really want to take too much more than 100 because I think there's real value in the intimacy of learning. But right now we're open.
Typo, real quickly, you know, I wondered, do you ever open up your creative process for people to watch you work?
No, not particularly. I'm usually by myself with...
You like the quiet
with
space
my dog.
And,
okay, yeah, there you go. She's the only one that sees really what's going on. Well, the thing is a lot of people don't know this, is I think about 90% of my work doesn't make it outside of the studio. So I have to go through a lot of trial and error before I really get the magic. So people just see the end result, and they don't see the months and years of work and failed attempts that go into it.
Most of the stuff you do is just for the trash can.
Yes, exactly.
This is a fascinating project. Again, Typo Grand, Miami-based artist. He's part of this. It is the new commissioner project, and Deisha Carrington is the founder of that. And again, commissioner, brand new arts initiative in Miami that allows collectors to invest in local artists for commissioned original pieces each quarter. And they're still looking for patrons to invest, again, at the $50 a year level to get access to all kinds of programs and even possibly meet the artists as well and possibly become a collector the following year when you guys do it again. Deisha, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Typo, thanks so much, man.
Thanks appreciate for having it. Me.
And that's the program for today. Again, you can always find us online at WLRN.org or on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Have a wonderful day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.